Okay, good afternoon. We are going to start this plenary afternoon session. And it is my great pleasure today to introduce Arthur Eckert, who is one of the pioneers of quantum information science. Arthur studied first at the Jagiellonian University in Warsaw and at the University of Oxford. So he's a real European. And in his doctoral thesis in Oxford in 1991, he showed how quantum entanglement and known locality can be used to distribute cryptographic keys in a perfectly secure way. And later he was a professor at Cambridge University, and then he is now a professor of quantum physics at the Mathematical Institute in Oxford University. He's also a professor at the National University of Singapore and the director of the CQT Center for Quantum Technologies over there. Arthur thus was one of the founders of quantum cryptography in Europe, and he strongly contributed to the strength of Europe in the field of quantum information. Now, with his position in Singapore, he also has a worldwide view over this subject, and he's going to give us a broad introduction to this very important field. Thank you, Arthur.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth, for this nice introduction. Well, I think you should wait till the end of the talk. Maybe I don't deserve it, really. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you to the organizers who took this risk to invite me to talk about quantum technologies and quantum computation. It's certainly a kind of a subject that may not be on the sort of agenda for another 2-3 years as far as the business opportunities are concerned, but nonetheless it's a fascinating topic that I would like to tell you about. So let me try to master the classical technology first. I guess I have to press F5 or maybe F9 or maybe any other number. So anyway, it's only a PDF file, so it should be visible soon. So in my talk, I would like to take you from a discussion about the limits of potential power of computing devices, no matter whether they're classical, quantum, or otherwise, and no matter what kind of laws of physics they may operate. And so I would like to in due time, I would like to show you a few things, but let me then perhaps start talking. So perhaps I can talk you through those things. Maybe at some point we'll have visuals. Otherwise, I will ask you to imagine certain things. So the story usually when we talk about the limits of computation, we tend to refer to a certain statement made by a person who at the time was at the head of Intel, Gordon Moore, who made a statement about really human ingenuity. He simply stated that that every 2 years or so, computers double in power. And what it means, they are getting smaller and smaller, And you can cram more and more components into a given volume of space. And and people have been speculating for years whether this particular law that's been sort of held in quite well over the last 10, 20 years, whether this can be extrapolated into the future. And of course, you know, physicists are one of those who were the first to wonder, well, what will happen really when, by this extrapolation, when you start entering into the dimension of molecules and you start cramming components which are of the size of the molecule or perhaps an atom into your computing device. So would there be a natural limitation at this point that would sort of stop the Moore's law? So as it happens, you know, Moore's law is not so much about the laws of physics, it's just about human ingenuity. And it turns out that it's perfectly possible when we reach the quantum level to keep on enhancing our computational power, not necessarily by cramming more components into a given volume, but also by using some other phenomena which are offered to us by quantum theory. So in other words, my bold statement at this point is that the Moore's law will probably continue, and it will continue not so much because we eventually will be able in a very simplistic way to put more and more components into a given volume of space, but also because we will be able to domesticate some newly discovered and very counterintuitive in many ways laws of quantum theory to our advantage to perform computations. Right, we almost there. Almost there, good. Wow, so okay, so thank you very much. So let me sort of back off a little bit and tell you and say that what I wanted to, my first slide was supposed to illustrate the danger of prediction. So I was asked to come here and talk about the future of computation, and the first thing that I realized is how difficult it is to make any reasonable statements about what's going to happen in, say, a decade or even, you know, in a few years' time. And there are remarkable examples that you can see here how predictions can go wrong. And people who at the time were in their own fields made statements that, of course, you know, were reasonable statements at the time. Like the chairman of the board of IBM said in 1943 that I think there's a market for at most, you know, 5 computers. And a few years later, a popular journal speculated about the future of computation and said, well, you know, we'll probably have something like about 1,000 vacuum tubes, and perhaps will weigh only 1.5 tons in the future. So now I feel that I'm here to just say something sensible about the future of computation, and I just eventually, probably 10 years down the line, I'll be just down the, you know, in 10 years I'll be looking at this at the statements from my talk and probably laugh. But nonetheless, there's this, as I mentioned, there's this one particular law, which is not so much the law of physics, but the law of human ingenuity, which seems to be sort of remarkably accurate, so that every 2 years or so, computers double in power. You can cram more and more components into a given volume of space. So will it continue like this? Then at this point, in order to speculate about the future of the Moore's law, one can just take two different approaches. One is a very simplistic approach, but still a very, you know, justified approach, which I think was in a way initiated by Feynman, who, American physicist, who said, you know, that why shouldn't it continue? There's a plenty room at the bottom. If you go into down into atomic scale by orders of magnitude, you discover there's lots of space there. So there's still a room, given a proper technology, there's still a room to cram many, many components into a given volume of space. So how much room is there? In order to visualize that, perhaps it's good to think about orders of magnitude from, say, a meter, both down into atomic scale and up into the galactic scale. So that gives you some, at least some kind of feeling what one order of magnitude, what a power of 10 can mean in this particular case. So when you take a meter and you go into the world where the world of molecules and the world of atom, which is something of the order of 10 to minus 10 meters, so that would be like, if you were to travel in the opposite direction into a macro scale, that would be like going to going into the solar system and exploring some neighboring planets. So there's really amazingly a lot there to pack the components into. And you know, as a physicist, you would quite often be asked a question, so what is, you know, okay, I mean, if you pack all those components, how much you can really pack into a given volume of space? How many bits, accessible bits and pieces of information you can have? How fast you can compute? And you know, if you push a physicist to a limit, the physicist can go ballistic and tell you, well, look, I don't know what the future technology will be, but I can certainly speculate on the basis of the known laws of physics, what would be the ultimate limits. I cannot tell you how you can achieve those limits, but nonetheless, some of them can be certainly estimated. So for example, if you take like a kilogram of matter, put it into a volume of 1 liter, so roughly a size of a laptop, right? And then ask a question, okay, well now, what would be the, if this is a 1 kilogram of computing matter, how fast it can compute. And then the physicist will say, well, look, you know, I mean, it depends really how much energy you can pump into this. So suppose you find a technology to convert all the mass of this 1 kilogram into energy, then you can probably, and there's a simple rule that can relate the speed of computation to the amount of energy you have, and then you can probably have something like 10 to the power 50 of operation per second. It's a huge number. It's, you know, in comparison, today we are talking about computers getting something like 10 to the 20 operation in such a bulk of matter. And then how about the number of bits that you can cram into this particular piece of 1 kilogram? That, again, can be estimated using some reasonable assumptions, even without knowing exactly how to access all those particular bits. That would be something of the order of 10 to the 30 bits, perhaps, or so. So those are huge numbers. And then if we were to extrapolate Moore's law to get those numbers, that would be something that will be approaching in the middle of the 23rd century, roughly, if you were to take the Moore's law and, you know, extrapolate. So I certainly think that this is a good proposal for a spaceship or something that would be issued in the first millennium of the 23rd century. So this, of course, is too unrealistic, and that is not necessarily the path to go. So I want to just scale down a little bit and tell you about perhaps much more sensible and much more interesting way to go as far as exploring some possibilities for the Moore's law to continue. And that is so let's go into much lower energies, and let's go into the world that we can more or less control, and let's look at the evolution of the technology, of the computing technology in this sort of range of energies. So if you look at the progress in computer technology, you can see that we are today somewhere at the scale of the microns or nanometers, where there are interesting possibilities in this twilight zone. So we are moving towards the molecular scale. That's certainly the case. And on one side, we are using conventional concepts of computation, nonetheless very interesting and powerful concepts, to explore possibilities of computing in a different way, still in a conventional way. And I will define conventional in a moment, but we are talking about interesting ideas in the area of neural networks, about self-programming devices, about possible computation with biological systems using DNA for computation. In fact, we are all becoming fascinated that with the ability to explore those dimensions, going to nanoscale and to smaller dimensions, you will be able to take all books that you read, all music that you listen to, all films that you watch, and squeeze it into a volume of a simple storing device that you can put into your pocket. So you can have your life in your pocket, and you can even have a simple program to analyze whether all rational decisions that you, or irrational decisions for that matter, that you made in your life and you tweeted about it, whether they were any good or not. So those are actually fascinating possibilities, but that is not exactly what perhaps physicists and many of my colleagues working in the field of computation find the most fascinating. If you just cross this twilight zone, the possibilities are in many ways much more surprising than what we can do with the classical devices today. So when we cross this twilight zone and go into the level of molecules and atoms, then the world, the physical world there, is the world of quantum phenomena that we simply have to not only take into account, but perhaps use to our advantage. And that, if we do that, that opens the possibility of immensely powerful computation. And it is indeed the fact, the one reason why it's so difficult for us sometimes to convey the message about where this extra power of computation comes from, is simply related to the fact that the quantum phenomena are counterintuitive, and most of us, even working in this field, find them still very puzzling, and explaining them somehow, going beyond equations and trying to talk to public at large about those phenomena, is still a big challenge. I think it was actually captured very nicely by this cartoon by ingenious Charles Adams in the New Yorker some time ago, that we do observe something like particles being two places at the same time and doing all kind of things with in the most amazing way. So let me give you a simple example what I mean by when I say unconventional, different, unusual kind of computation. So if it is not from the ability to squeeze many, many, many components into a given volume of space, so where is this extra power of computation we are talking about coming from? Well, one way of explaining this is perhaps to say that quantum physics can offer certain components that are not available in, or that perhaps even we would be tempted to believe they don't exist. So here's one example. Take a logician, go and talk to your friend who is a logician who never heard about quantum computing and ask him this question. Is it possible to have a simple operation, a logical operation, such that when you operate on a single bit and when you operate twice with the same operation, you get a logical operation not? So you negate the bit value. However, So in other words, you define a logical operation by a concatenation property. You say that I have this device, a logic gate, and then when I apply two independent logic gates, one after another, I get an operation not. So call this operation a square root of not. Now, any logicians will tell you that such an operation is simply impossible. It doesn't exist. And there are ways of proving that. And indeed, it doesn't exist in conventional logic. You may consider another operation, say a square root of swap. Take two bits and consider an operation of that type, that if you repeat this operation twice, you swap the bit values of those two bits. So let's call it a square root of swap. Again, you try to construct a truth table for such an operation, and you cannot. I mean, it is very easy to convince yourself on a piece of paper that such operations do not exist. But what does it mean they do not exist? If you can build an operation like that, then clearly they do exist. So and indeed, they do exist. I mean, the fact that square root of not can be as simple as as a half-silver mirror. If your bit values are determined by a position of a photon, you can take a beam splitter, a half-silver mirror, and you can show that if you take two of them, the photon will be simply taken from a path labeled as zero into a path labeled as one and vice versa. So in other words, there is a physical implementation of an operation square root of naught. And if there is, it does exist. So by learning something about or being able to use the new physical phenomena that we discover, we are also able to increase our repertoire of possible computational operations. So now you can introduce this operation, and in fact, you can introduce many other operations. You can introduce the square root of naught, you can introduce the square root of swap, and some other operations that have no classical analog whatsoever. Nonetheless, physicists today in the lab can build those components. And there is even more surprise. So not only this, so they can build those components and try to put them together to perform operations based on logical primitives that in a way are not known to classical computation. In this sense, you kind of build impossible devices using impossible logical operations. And so that's at least the concept and the idea for quantum computation. So at least at this point you can see that it is inherently different. It's not like taking the paradigm of classical computation and trying to modify it, make it more complex, make it more interesting, make it more fun. So it's a kind of a different way of doing this. There's a completely different concept behind it. But now you may say, fine, we can see that this is different, that this is inherently different. Why is it more powerful? Where this extra power comes from? So let me then try to go back into this previous diagram that I showed you. When you look at a very simple experiment where you have two beam splitters or two half-silver mirrors, something that physicists call a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, and you can put pieces of glass in optical paths in between, it turns out where the photon goes at the end depends crucially on the difference, and I stress the difference, between the thickness of those glasses or in the difference in optical paths in this particular device. So how come this photon, just one photon, knows about the difference? In order to know about the difference in optical path, you have to explore one path and you have to explore another one, and then you know about the difference. If you go only through one of those two paths, there's just no way you can know what the other is. And somehow the photon does know. And that is actually a very interesting thing that more you play with experiments like this, more you are getting convinced that this one entity, one photon, had to travel through both paths at the same time. There's just simply no other explanation for this. And by doing so, if you think about this photon representing one logical bit, by doing so, it certainly entered what physicists call a superposition of two values. So it is possible for one physical bit to encode both 0 and 1 at the same time. And then take, 50 quantum bits known as qubits. Then they will represent, you put the first one into a superposition and you have two numbers. You put the second one into a superposition, you have four numbers. And it goes like power of two. So there is a really exponential increase of possible values that you can keep in your computers with a very simple set of operations that is to your disposal. So what quantum computers, if I were then just to, again, in a few slides explain the difference. A classical computer, whatever that is, however complex this machine is, usually follows two different ways of solving a problem. Either it goes in a truly deterministic way from one configuration to another, to another, to another, and ends up in a certain final state that we call the output. Or perhaps you can program it in such a way that it can randomly choose certain paths and configurations, and that certainly is a very powerful, actually more powerful method of programming many devices, where they kind of randomly choose certain possibilities. And we have examples of certain problems that we can solve efficiently using probabilistic approach rather than deterministic approach. Now, a quantum computer would be very similar to probabilistic computer, apart from the fact that the computation can really follow several paths at the same time, in the same way as in this simple interferometer that I showed you before. And by doing so, it is not only that you have to just put it in more technical terms, add probabilities in two different paths that end up in the same output, but some other quantities, some complex numbers, which are known as probability amplitudes. And that they have this property that the output can be either enhanced in terms of probability, so the probability of seeing a given output can be enhanced by a certain interference of those factors, or even suppressed by a negative interference. So the whole art of programming quantum computers is to make sure that the right answers are amplified by quantum interference and the wrong answers are suppressed by negative interference. So that's an art on its own. And it's all really contributes. So those interference patterns can generate results which are absolutely powerful in a sense that we don't really know how to program a classical computer to solve a class of problems that quantum computers can solve. So computer scientists like to divide problems depending on how efficiently they can solve the problems or whether we know or do not an efficient algorithm for a given problem into the so-called complexity classes. I'm not going to go into this, but the fact is that the class of problems that quantum computers will be able to solve is much larger. And in fact, it admits certain problems that cannot even be formulated in classical terms and might be important for future applications. So the impact of quantum computers is not only restricted to abilities to solve certain problems that classical computers cannot. One can even speculate, although I have to say we don't have a concrete example of this, one can even speculate about a situation where you ask your quantum machine to prove a certain proposition for you, and a computer will go into those superpositions, those branches, will check whether a given proposition is true by analyzing many, many, many cases, and it can easily go into a number superposition that will supersede the number of atoms in the known universe. You need, say, something of the order of 100 ions or so to create a number of superpositions that probably will exceed any known number of matter in the universe. So that is certainly possible. But suppose that indeed you somehow manage to control a computer that will just come back and say, well, actually this logical proposition is true. And the interesting thing is that because you are not allowed to disturb quantum computer in the process of computation, there's just no way to verify, there's no way to produce a proof or a record of this proof. So in other words, you have to trust the physical process, you have to trust the laws of physics in your ability to make statements about some truth in mathematical logic, which is something that if you talk to logicians, they find it as absolutely shocking that they have to at some point talk to physicists and say, well, no, we have to trust this machine, we have to trust that the machine is doing what it is doing. And in classical domain, it's still not a big deal because you can analyze every single part. You can ask this machine to produce a complete record of what it did and when. But it's not the case in the quantum domain. So such a record is simply too huge to be recorded in all possible atoms that are given to your disposal. So that then the concept of trust in the quantum machine is actually much more important in this particular case. Well, it all boils down to, and of course, you know, I try to argue that this exponential power is due to quantum interference will hold, but then, of course, you know, an obvious question from more pragmatic colleagues is, well, but how will you do it? Can you really build devices that in the long run will be able to control quantum interference in the way that is desired and required for quantum computing? Well, you know, we know certainly how to build basic units of quantum computation, some simple interference patterns, and we can do it in all kind of ways. You know, and those things, those devices do exist in our labs today. You can do it with photons, you can do it with ions, you can do it with atoms if you want, throwing them through sequence of cavities, you can do it with many other technologies. The question is, you know, how will eventually they look up those computers? I really don't know. There are different technologies. Some of them are good for something. Some of them are good for something else. There are several criteria that have to be satisfied to give you a good control over quantum phenomena. And at this point, it is not entirely clear which particular technology will be the best. Perhaps there will be a hybrid of technologies that will take you there. And all technologies are tried by our colleagues in labs all over Europe and all over the world today. And they range from controlling, say, Rydberg atoms in optical lattices, controlling NV centers in dimers, controlling a bunch of cesium atoms into different locations. And they all have something to contribute to this emerging area of quantum technologies. But if you then press me and ask me, so where we are, what are the chances that we have this particular, that we have a computer, a quantum computer in not too distant future? Well, perhaps a good analogy is to take an analogy with a building a magnificent church or magnificent cathedral or so. So you see, if you start with a, historically, if you look at the development of architecture, you know, you have a brick. Then, you know, after a while, if you have a good material, you can build a wall. And then that's okay. You can build beautiful temples. For example, the ancient Greeks managed to build beautiful temples, building basically walls and putting stones on top of them. But if you look at the Roman architecture, then you see that there is a significant difference. What Romans had and the Greeks didn't was the concept of the arch. So arch changed all, you know, the rules of the game in architecture, because out of the sudden, putting, you know, it's still same material. You put the bricks and put them in the form of the arch, and then you can have a vaulted ceiling, and then you can have a dome, and then you can cover a huge area with, you know, even a smaller number of bricks that you would need for building, say, a Greek temple of the same size, which would have to be a completely different architectural concept. And then you can scale it up. Once you have an arch, you can have a vault, you can have a vaulted ceiling, and then you can scale it up and up and build the beautiful things. So using this analogy, where are we in our development of quantum technologies? So I think that certainly we have the bricks. We have basic components. Physicists can isolate individual atoms or ions or photons and play simple operations with them. So those are elementary quantum logic gates, like the square root of naught, square root of swap, and the like. We do have them, so we have the bricks. Even we can build a wall, we can put some of them together and see them interacting in a reasonable fashion. And then there's this crucial moment that we know how to do it in theory. There's this question of building a fault-tolerant quantum structure. So that is a little bit like taking all those bricks and building an arch. You cannot build an arch with 2, 3, 4, 5 bricks. You need quite a few of them, and they have to be pretty good. So we know that the same is possible. We have a statement about quantum fault tolerance. You know that with a certain number of quantum gates, with a certain level of complexity, you can build a fault-tolerant quantum operation. So that's like building the arch. And then we can scale it up. There's nothing in principle that prevents us from doing this, but we are not quite there. So in this architectural analogy, I think what is needed for quantum technologies is to push it through this sort of, to the level where it actually can build a simple, stable structure like an arch. Then things will become much, much easier, and eventually there will be a computer that will rely on quantum phenomena. How exactly it will work, I honestly don't know. I don't think anyone knows at this point. There may be also another way of looking at the problem. You may say, hey, why we just, you know, don't look for quantum phenomena in nature? Perhaps they do exist, and perhaps we can harness them to our advantage. Well, for a long period of time, there was a belief that, you know, that's very unlikely, because in all this world with a thermal equilibrium, then things, we don't see that quantum phenomena, and they are not very conspicuous. But quite recently, researchers from Berkeley and from other labs discovered that indeed for a short period of time you can have a signature of quantum coherence, of quantum interference in biological systems. So for example, there are certain bacteria that live in rather dark environment, so they develop a very efficient process of capturing a photon whenever they can just get a photon and transferring very fast the energy from the photon from what is called a light harvesting antenna into a chemical reaction center. And this transfer goes through a sequence of excitations, and those excitations are kept coherent. What is the role of quantum coherence is not entirely clear. At least we still have to work harder to understand this process. But, you know, one can immediately come up with an interesting idea of doing quantum computation with a set of, say, sulfur bacteria. You can simply prepare light for them. You can prepare certain states of light that you just inject into the light harvesting antennas. And then if you can control the other side where the excitons go to, then we know that in principle we can be able to perform a certain basic operation. So I find it actually quite amusing that to think that in the lab you can have a bunch of bacteria doing a quantum computation for you. But that's one of those ideas. However wacky and fantastic they are, they are certainly just within the realm of possibilities. So if just to come to the end with this futuristic talk. When we talk about quantum computation, I think there are different communities that look at this and look at it from a slightly different perspective. When you talk to people who are really interested in technologies, you know, this hardcore technologies engineers, then you have to talk to them about Moore's law and about what we can do and how we can control nature and how we can build new kind of gates. When you talk to physicists are much more relaxed about building computers. Of course, they want to play with quantum phenomena, but I think the main motivation there is to understand how those things work before we do something sensible. In fact, many physicists probably would like to come to conclusion that you cannot build a quantum computer. Because if you can honestly show that there's a good and valid and fundamental reason for us not to build a quantum computer, that's much better than building one, because we learn about nature so much at this point. So if we can understand why, it would be like, you know, understanding most of the laws of physics can be formulated as a no-go, so like the conservation of energy, you cannot violate it. You cannot violate the third law of thermodynamics. You cannot violate something else. So if there is a statement that you cannot build such a device, it will be a very profound statement. Now, computer scientists take a different approach. They are interested in potential power. So they talk about complexity classes. They think what kind of problems we can solve with those computers, how they modify what we can do, how they modify the power of computation, the ability to construct different algorithms. And when you talk to mathematicians or logicians, they say, well, maybe after all, the mathematical knowledge relies on our knowledge of physics. It doesn't mean that the truth of logic depend on physics. I'm not saying this. They have an objective existence of their own, but our access to those truths may be only available through a certain physical phenomena, and more we know about physics, more we know about the world of logic and mathematics. So there are different communities, and they have a slightly different take on this field, and all of them interesting, and it's fantastic that those communities are able to talk to each other. In fact, the fusion of computer science and physicists at the quantum level was amazingly productive. Computer scientists managed to bring some issues related to communication complexity to physicists, and then physicists could address some problems of quantum entanglement and the like. So there's the whole, you know, growing area of fantastic collaboration. Of course, you know, it required computer scientists and physicists to learn to talk to each other. The language is somewhat different, and it took some time for computer scientists to accept that if a computer is a physical machine, then physicists have something to say about computation. And then there are, of course, big questions, so that go even beyond those that I mentioned. There are questions about the inherent randomness that is represented by quantum theory. So somehow, since Laplace and others, we thought about randomness as our inability to compute, to be able to see the order. It was at the purely epistemological level. Whether randomness seems to, at least if you're prepared to divide the world into quantum and classical, then the randomness appears in quantum theory at the very deep inherent level, at the sort of ontological level, which is something we still have to come to terms with. And certainly some physicists like Albert Einstein couldn't accept this, so that's... And then there's a question of, that leads into some other fundamental questions that philosophers and physicists more often just these days look into: the nature of reality, perception of reality. It has some impact. I didn't talk about this, but the quantum theory has amazing impact on data security and just about everything else sooner or later. However, if you want to formulate a program for development of quantum technologies, a sensible program, I think then there are at least two questions one should really address in the next 10 or 20 years. So those questions are, to investigate what is the true power of quantum computers, what problems do they allow us to solve, and what do they teach us about the nature around us? So that's a fundamental thing. And more on the engineering side, you may just ask, well, what are the limits to our ability of control and manipulate nature, simple systems or quantum systems? Is there a natural limit for that or no? And what are the constraints that our abilities play on technology itself? So if you want, write them down and submit to Fed Open or whatever. But I think that those questions have to be addressed, and they will be addressed, because there's no other options for us. If we don't understand those questions, then it will be very difficult to understand the nature of computation in the future. And so, well, basically, in my talk, I try to say, well, however dangerous those predictions are, nonetheless, one can say with a certain degree of certainty that there's no other way for technology to go than into the quantum domain. I think that it is quite clear that we have to go there, whether we want this or not. It is also clear that we have technology to tackle control of quantum phenomena. We have to develop this technology further. It needs some push. It needs some push to build this architectural arch on which you can build a more complicated architectural structures. And it seems to have so much impact and bring so many different communities together, then this is like one of those areas where you really feel excited that you should go and boldly go into and peek outside this known realm of classical computation to this weird domain of quantum, as this gentleman on this picture here. And I hope that this will be something that Europe will be competing well with a growing number of researchers and labs in Asia and United States. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Arthur, for this very interesting talk that raises a lot of deep and interdisciplinary questions that I think we are not going to answer right now, but maybe there are questions in the public.
Yeah, maybe I repeat your question, Sal.
Yeah, we want to have it deterministic because, you know, as you said in your talk, in the end we want a result we can 100% rely on. And we also, of course, want to check during the computation, at least in principle, that the computer was doing the right thing, that there was not a kind of error where a bit was just flipped by some, you know, influence and whatever. And yes. I think, you know, with quantum computation, of course, you go into the stochastic kind of field, and you have to, but nevertheless, you have to make sure when you build such a device that still the photon checks, of course, all possibilities where it's going to, but still it's in a sense, you must know the probability distribution. It cannot shift during the computation somehow.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Right, so the two questions really that you've raised. So the first one is the difference between the deterministic and stochastic or probabilistic computation. Well, actually, it's not that we're really so much into deterministic computation today, because there are Monte Carlo methods and all kind of algorithms that rely on probability. In fact, for a long period of time, that the best program we had to test whether a given number was prime or not was based on probability. So you could say, well, give me the probability of error in my judgment, I can answer you with this and this probability if I run my program long enough. So randomness is actually perceived more and more as an asset rather than something that you should avoid. Of course, as long as you can control it within the limits. Now, for your second question about the quantum computing, actually, we do not necessarily, it is indeed very much related to probabilistic computation, but it is not the case that we have to check all possibilities when we build a quantum device. It's simply impossible. There are just too many of them. So we have to rely on our knowledge and understanding of quantum theory to build this device. And according to the theory, it should give such and such a predictions. But many of them, of course, are never tested. It is like in a computing device, in a sense, of course, you never test all possibilities, because if you were to test them, there would be no need to compute them in the first place, right? So you build a device, and the construction relies on the knowledge of physics that you have. You know that this device is doing what it's supposed to be doing, although it was never tested on all possible inputs and all possible outputs. So the same in physics, in quantum theory. We have understanding how to build a machine, and we'll never test it on all possible inputs and all possible outputs, because it wouldn't be possible to start with. We wouldn't have never time to do that, and also it would be pointless in most cases, because the whole concept of computation is to present some input to which you don't know the answer to. So I think this shows that we have to really understand how physics works, and that gives us confidence that our machine is doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I have a question, perhaps a little bit on the border between physics, computation, and philosophy. In a way, you gave this nice example with the Romans and the Greeks and the architecture that they have been using and scaling up. So when we come back to this ancient era and the people that were, well, acting and working at that time, so they also used to have an oracle. I mean, they were consulting the oracle, what they have to do when they, you know, for almost anything. So can you imagine that in future, when we have built already this many quantum computers, or perhaps a lot of them, so that people will start asking them what to do? In a way, because they can calculate all possible, as you said, many possibilities, and to know the future, what to do.
Yes, actually,
to have a quantum computer oracle. And a second question connected to this, with the origin of the universe. Can you, imagine that, the development of the quantum computation and the usage of it in future can influence in some way, if you know the theory about the multiverse, can influence the evolution of the universe in some way. Thank you.
Okay, so the first question about the oracle, whether you can ask a computer in future about things that you would have no clue, the answer is of course yes. But there's interesting another aspect of my answer to your question. In computer science, there is a concept of an oracle. It is a piece of the machine, or it is something that you can consult and get the answer yes or no without analyzing the complexity of this object. And many quantum algorithms are based around the concept of an oracle. Unfortunately, you know, those algorithms with oracles in them are very difficult to judge in terms of the complexity classes. But nonetheless, oracles do play a role in the, certainly they play a role in the evolution of the concept of quantum algorithms. Now, the second question about to what extent quantum computations will tell us about the laws of physics, and you mentioned the concept of multiverse. Well, actually, again, as it happened at the very origin of quantum computation, in the 80s, late 80s, where David Deutsch in Oxford came up with the idea of quantum Turing machine, what he had in mind partially was the ability to test different interpretations of quantum theory, including the Everett interpretation of the error. And I do hope, of course, you know, that's not only I do hope, I think it's probably obvious that once you have those tools, you can only use them to understand nature better. So they will play a role, whether they will answer some deep and profound questions about how we should understand quantum theory, that I don't know, but certainly they will play a role in our understanding of nature. For one thing, if we don't have quantum devices like that, if we don't have quantum simulators, we cannot even make predictions, simply because there are some, take 20 particles and make them interfere. And suppose that if you don't see a count in one particular detector, that means that quantum theory is refuted. But you cannot make predictions for this kind of interference on a classical computer. Simply, just there's no way to do it. So you have to probably have another device and use quantum computers in the same way we use classical computers today to do the simulations of other physical phenomena to be able to answer them. So I think that they will certainly play a fundamental role in our understanding of nature.
Okay, thank you very much. I think in view of the time passing, we have to stop here. Thank you again, Arthur. Thank you.